a common understanding about the Quran, that some verses of the Quran explain and provide an explanation about other verses. So all the verses you can find, other verses which are related to the same meaning, same themes, the same subject matter. And especially when we talk about this surah, the Al-Asr, when we talk about this, as we mentioned before, it's a very it's a program for the whole of the life of a Muslim person. Mm-hmm. The whole life is explained. The program and the manifesto mm-hmm. of the, yes. or the charter, which is Islam has come with for mankind, to how to manage this world, how to live in this world, mm-hmm. and how to connect it with the hereafter. So the whole theme, the whole message of Islam is here in a very intensive way. Everything has been brought under this. Therefore, certainly the whole of the Quran is talking about what Islam, the human being, has to do.
Yes.
Human behavior is being discussed. Human conduct is being discussed. And here it is also there in a way that you can explain and expand upon it and take the help of other holy verses to explain that. For example, when we talk about the meaning of, again, when we talk about, for example, as we're going to talk about the faith and iman and the amal salih, we can find many verses which are related to this. Or, for example, when we're talking about that mankind is at a loss, is going to, you know, is facing a great loss.
Yes.
So we can find other verses, for example, which are talking about this, khusran.
Mm-hmm.
So many verses are there where the khusran mubin is discussed.
Right.
So as we go on into the verses, one by one, the three verses which we have, and when we reflect upon the various themes and the terms that have been mentioned, we can refer back to many other verses where the same theme has been mentioned from a different angle, for example.
Right.
So therefore, certainly when we are going to discuss the verses, and when we discuss the concepts and the terms which are there mentioned in those verses, we shall certainly refer back to other verses which are mentioning the same thing.
Yes.
And getting a complete picture. When we talk about the thematic interpretation and explanation of the Quran, there are two ways the thematic tafsir can be presented. One is that you take one concept, all other verses which have the similar concept, you bring them together and you build a complete picture.
Right.
Another way of the thematic presentation of the Quran is that you come up with an idea of how to manage the affairs of the world.
Mm.
You come up with a systematic approach to life. You, for example, you talk about the economic system of Islam, you talk about the social system of Islam, you talk about the political system of Islam. You come up with various concepts referring to that. Then you present them in front of the Quran and ask the Quran to tell you if you're going on the right, on the right path.
I see.
So you have come up with a different a concept, a theme, or a systematic representation of the Islamic teachings, and then you present it and ask the Quran to guide me. That is this correct? So, especially when it comes to the Surah Al-Asr, here the main theme of of Amal Saleh, for example, is presented in such a way that from this the whole concept of Islam, Islamic teachings, especially the teachings which are to be presented in a modern way,
mm-hmm.
how to present Islam to mankind and tell them that Islam not only talks about beliefs, it's not only talking about practices, rather it is giving you a whole system of life.
I see. Well, I have lots of questions regarding that, but we have to actually take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Quran Quest, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
إن سألتم عن الله فهو رحمن رحيم أنزل الشارع حنيفا رحمة للعالمين رحمة للعالمين.
This is Quran Quest.
on IRIB English Radio. It's a program that attempts to answer your questions pertaining to the Noble Quran. We'd be delighted to have your comments about the program. Just search Quran Quest on IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me who my God is, on whose name I call, if you ask me who my God is, He's the God of us all, Allah the Merciful. If you ask me what my book is that I hold in my hand, if you ask me what my book is, it's the Holy Quran, the Holy Quran.
Back to the program Quran Quest on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Salman Naghavi, my guest speaker, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University. We are discussing some of the key issues and concepts of one of the shortest chapters of the Quran, Al-Asr, or Time. Sayyid, before the break, you talked about many issues. Actually, you gave us the bigger picture of this chapter and the verses and how they relate to the other verses of the Quran. And you gave us these two thematic schemes of the Quran, basically. Well, there are lots of questions that I'd like to ask you. And one of them is about the afterlife. How does this chapter relate to the afterlife? Is it through the term faith?
No, actually, it's reflected in the term where we're talking about khusr. In al insan lafi khusr.
Right.
It's saying that the whole of mankind, al insan, as a genus, as not just one man.
The general
concept of the genus of not the species.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about the species of the man, you're talking about
the kind.
One person.
Yes.
But
one.
When you the kind, yes. So the whole species of mankind, in the general sense,
right,
it is going towards total loss.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is going for that. There's
so
no
it
exception.
Involves every human being.
And it's talking about actually the hereafter. It's talking about the other life that we're going towards. Ya ayyuhal insan innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadhan fa mulaqih. Mankind, you are moving towards and striving towards and endeavoring towards Allah Almighty.
Right.
You are moving towards Him and you shall meet Him.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, in what condition and what state are we going to meet Him? That is important. And as far as the concept of loss, khusran goes, we shall discuss that in detail. But
Yes. Basically,
the thing is, that another holy verse, as we said, that other verses are there which we can refer back to. We have a verse which says, "Im minkum illa wariduha." There is no one amongst you. "Im minkum illa wariduha." There is no one amongst mankind who will not enter hell. Every human being shall enter hell. Because we talk about the sirat, and the sirat, people have to cross over it in the hereafter.
Right.
And everyone is going to cross over it, go over it, and enter hell, and some people will come out the other side towards heaven.
Yes.
And others will remain in hell. They won't be able to pass through the sirat,
okay,
the path which is leading to heaven. So there's a concept of totality, that every human being is going to enter
hell.
So here there's
okay,
a sim- here is a similar concept.
I see.
Innal insana lafi khusr.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a break and then we'll be back and continue our program Quran Quest on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us. Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio. Back to the program Quran Quest on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Salman Naghavi, my guest speaker, faculty member of Al-Mustafa University, in our program discussing with me and enlightening on the key concepts and notions of the chapter Al-Asr, or time. You said that every human being, in fact, tastes hell, right? Before the break. Is that so with even the good people, those who have faith?
Everyone.
Why should they go to hell?
Generalization. The generalization is there. Everyone is going to pass through. It shows that as human beings, since we have both faculties of goodness and faculties of evil,
yeah,
there's within us, within the human construct that has been created by Allah Almighty.
You mean it's embedded in our nature?
It is there in our
nature.
In our innate nature. Of course, yes. Our innate true nature is the fitrah, as it is called.
Yeah, that's pure.
That is pure. That is divine. That leads us towards God. But with that, we have the physical aspects.
The animalistic
dimensions, instincts.
Of human, yeah, facet, yeah.
They bring us down, away from Allah.
But
they
those people...
They cling onto us in such a way that they want us to remain embedded in the ground, on the earth, and not to move spiritually up towards Allah Almighty.
Yeah.
So those two together go hand in hand. And from the very, the Quran talks...
Why do the good people should go there, like to hell?
But they won't suffer.
They have faith, all right, and they do good deeds.
Yes.
So if, this is what the logic demands. Well, if you're a good person, if you have faith in God and the resurrection and the rest of it, so you should go to heaven.
No, maybe it's because, number one, the instinctively human beings have this... this probability or this condition is there, or this
inclination,
potential is there that they can go down.
I see.
And they've...
And going down is easier, by the way.
It is easier, for example. And they have to lift themselves up. And on the Day of Judgment, when people are going to be when they're being judged, and they're being passed to go towards heaven, for example, so they will be maybe shown the hell, shown that you have passed this, and you have made safe, protected yourself. As you did in this world, this physical world. When you go there in the hereafter, maybe God wants to show you that, look, you have protected yourselves.
Right.
I am just telling you, showing you this is hell.
Thank you very much, Sayyid. That was Sayyid Salman Naghavi, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University, my guest speaker in the program Quran Quest on IRIB English Radio. We discuss some of the key concepts of the verses of one of the shortest chapters of the Holy Quran, Al-Asr, or time. Of course, we haven't finished discussing these key concepts, and inshallah, we'll continue doing so in the upcoming episodes. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Quran Quest, the program that answers your Quranic questions.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
7 barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You are listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasir, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajhum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. The book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is titled Karbala and Beyond, written by Brother Jassin T.L. Jiburi. We would also like to send our sincere condolences to the Imam of the time, Imam al-Sahib al-Asri wal-Zaman, and to all the Muslims, especially the lovers of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. As today is the 13th of the blessed month of Muharram, and it is a day after the reported Shahada of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. An Imam who took great strides and made great efforts to ensure that the path of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam stayed alive, who ensured that the teachings of his great-grandfather Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wasallam remained firm within the minds and within the Muslims throughout the ages. There are many things that the Imam alayhi salam did. Some of the most important things that the Imam did was obviously the training of students who then went out into the world and taught people by their actions the true nature of Islam, the true nature of the teachings of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He also then taught people the spiritual path, the way to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by means of supplication. And his most famous book, one of the most important books that we have in our midst, which is a great blessing for us, especially during this time of occultation, of Imam al-Zaman and Jannallahu ta'ala Farajum Sharif, which is As-Sahifa As-Sajjadiyah, a book that contains 54 immaculate and, you know, precious gems, each of them having a, you know, bright light illuminating from them. And it's up to us to kind of extract that light and inculcate that light into our daily lives, inshallah. But this is about Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam. A lot can be said about this blessed Imam. But anyway, inshallah, for more information and for more detailed information regarding the book that we have introduced at the beginning, please stay tuned to our next segment.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. So as mentioned in our first segment, the book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled Karbala and Beyond. It was written by Sheikh Yasin T. Al-Jiburi and was published, one of the last times it was published was by Ansarin Publications, which is located in the blessed city of Qom in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It was published, or one of the times it was published, was in 1999. Yasin T. Al-Jiburi has written many books. Many of his books were published within the United States of America. Another one of his books is titled Mary and Jesus. And he has many other books as well that the dear listeners can go and find out more information about those. So this particular book contains a brief yet documented narrative of an incident that took place in Karbala. This is from the introduction of the book. Iraq in 61 AH after Hijrah, or in 680 AD. It has stamped the history of the Muslim nation ever since and will continue to do so till the reappearance of the awaited one, the Mahdi from among the offspring of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. It refers to a revolution against tyranny and oppression led by Imam al-Hussein, son of Imam Ali, son of Abu Talib and grandson of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. So this book is written in a few parts. So some of the titles of this book are as follows. It begins with a dedication. It has the publisher's preface. This publisher's preface is the publisher's preface by the American publisher, not the Iranian publisher. It has a prologue. It then has an introduction. Part one speaks about Hussein and his foes, martyrdom. Then a summary of post-martyrdom events, the revolution's outcome, Hussein's successes, the nine infallible imams. It then concludes. The last two are appendixes. One is the Arabic poems that were mentioned in eulogizing Imam Hussein alayhi salam are mentioned, and obviously some of them are translated. And then a glossary of Islamic terms that were used in the particular text are explained further. So this is the structure of this particular book. And this is, you know, obviously it's not a detailed history of the events of Karbala itself, but rather a general history around the event before, after, and during. So inshallah, for the benefit of our dear listeners, in our next segment, we will be reading a portion of this book. So please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled Karbala and Beyond. It was written by Brother or Sheikh Yasin T. Al-Jiburi and was published in 1999, or one of the times it was published, it was in 1999 in the Islamic Republic of Iran in the blessed city of Qom by Ansarian Publications. So one of the sections in this book, as we mentioned, deals with the events that happened after the event of Karbala. And one of those events that happened after the event of Karbala was the uprising of Al-Mukhtar Al-Thaqafi. Again, there's a lot of different narrations and historical facts that can be discussed here. But again, as a brief introduction, the author brings it. So we will read that particular section for the benefit of our dear listeners. Al-Mukhtar Al-Thaqafi, at the same time when Ibn Ziyad ordered the captives, that is the captives of Imam Hussein alayhi salam's family, to be brought to his meeting place, he also ordered Al-Mukhtar, son of Abu Ubaid Al-Thaqafi, to be brought to him too. Al-Mukhtar had been in prison since the assassination of Muslim ibn Aqil. When Al-Mukhtar saw that horrific and most deplorable scene, he sighed. He sighed loudly, and an exchange of harsh words took place between him and Ibn Ziyad, wherein the harshest words were Al-Mukhtar's. Ibn Ziyad became burning with outrage and ordered him to be sent back to jail. Some say that he was whipped, blinding one of his eyes. After the execution of Ibn Afif, Al-Mukhtar was released due to the interference of Abdullah son of Umar ibn al-Khattab, who asked Yazid to have him released. Yazid was the husband of Al-Mukhtar's sister, Safiya, daughter of Abu Ubaid al-Thaqafi. But Ibn Ziyad postponed carrying out Yazid's order for 3 days. So this is one of the events that occurred after, and there's a lot to speak about regarding Mukhtar al-Thaqafi. Anyway, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to assist us in understanding the true history, and not only the history and not just, you know, words and historic anecdotes, but rather to implement these things in our lives, inshallah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasir, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom. Thank you.
targeting of Palestinian children. The men and women of Gaza are busy piecing their lives back together, attempting bravely to cope with extensive loss of life and displacement, and thousands of innocent children suffer deep trauma every day since having their families, friends, homes, hospitals, schools, etc., deliberately, intentionally bombed by Israel with its military. The story of the suffering they experienced and continue to experience is told in the looks on their faces, full of sadness and despair, especially whenever they recall the 50 days of war they witnessed and survived in 2014. At the end of that war, the number of martyrs killed on the Palestinian side reached nearly 2,500, including 500 young children. The number of the wounded amassed to 12,000, of whom 3,300 were young children. Every child of Palestine now carries with them memories of explosions, of screams of horror, of seeing dismembered and burnt bodies, of the smell of death brought down on them by the inhumane, unconscionable actions of Israel in its efforts to oppress its occupied territory. A tank massacre here, an airstrike massacre there, is all justified by Israeli politicians and condoned by Western governments that protect these Israeli war criminals from ever facing justice in court.
This is the first time I've entered the school since the incident. It's painful and depressing for me. Inside the school, I felt my brother's presence, as if he was calling my name. He was martyred here. I also got a sense that my mother wanted me to pray for him here. The feeling is of utter sadness and grief.
Hussein and Ibrahim are standing on the ruins of the house overlooking the school in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. This school belongs to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. UNRWA is a UN organization. They recall back to the second day of the month of August 2014.
We are staying at the house of the late Shabab Ahmed al-Shinbari. Here there are 25 family members all living in a three-floor house, 150 square meters. The Israeli occupation forces targeted this house during its 2014 military aggression on the population of Gaza. We were evacuated quickly and headed to the UNRWA school in Beit Hanun shortly before our house was bombarded.
It was midnight when they blew a hole in our house with a tank shell about where we are sitting. We escaped to my uncle's second house, but they dropped gas bombs there. My aunt said we should prepare ourselves to go in different directions in the morning. We went to my aunt's house in Al-Gharman Street, but the Jews entered and demanded us to leave. Finally, we went to the Western school at Beit Hanun.
We moved from our home on the first day of the ground incursion mounted by Israeli forces. We went to Beit Hanun Co-ed School A and D blocks. A municipal vehicle arrived on Thursday to transport us to another school because children at Beit Hanun had been hit by shrapnel. There was a bombardment near the school where we were sheltering.
We have informed the IDF, nearly 32 times about the school, its place, who were in that school, what they are doing, and, everything, that it is should be a safe place, that you have the UN flags and the GPS had been sent to the Israeli side. The real information, in real time, we were sending them every day about everything.
Officials at the UNRWA Relief Agency in Gaza believed Israeli army assurances regarding the guaranteed safety of their accommodation centers, accordingly informing the displaced people that a school in Beit Hanun, which was sheltering hundreds of Palestinian refugees, was a safe zone. Like blood to a vampire, however, this gathering of displaced families incited the appetite of the Israeli occupation army for killing, which found easy prey. They informed the UNRWA Relief Agency and International Red Cross to evacuate the school of the displaced. The people gathered in the school yard and waited for the arrival of buses to take them somewhere safe. All of them a clear and easy target for slaughter. The Israelis rounded them up and killed 16 of them where they stood, mostly children, and wounded more than 55 others.
The Red Cross came 2 days earlier. There were 3 Red Cross vehicles and 10 Red Crescent vehicles. They announced that they came to transport the most serious cases, such as those with disabilities, the elderly, and the injured, mostly shrapnel injuries. As they took people away, we asked them what was going on, and if they thought the school was safe. They confirmed it was safe and that there was nothing to fear. We trusted that information. The UN and the Red Cross came 2 days later with buses to move more of us to the Jabalia refuge camp. People gathered in together and we all went downstairs.
My aunt was collecting laundry and about to sit and rest when the shells pounded us. Shrapnel sliced open my stomach and my intestines fell to the ground. My brother found me lying underneath my siblings. He moved me outside and on foot he took me to the Kamal Odwan Hospital. They urgently referred me to Ashifa Hospital, where I went under surgery. 10 centimeters of my intestines were cut off. Now every time I eat and when I drink water, my stomach hurts.
Five of my family were martyred, praise be to Allah. 16 other people were injured, including Manar, who lost both her legs, Ibrahim, whose intestine were reconnected, and my brother Mahmoud, who had his arteries severed.
What happened in that school, it was a real catastrophe, actually. We have tens of people that had been killed and injured in that school. The Board of Inquiry investigated, you know, what happened in Beit Hanun school. It is a message, you know, that here in the Gaza Strip, that there is no safe place, even in a school, on the street, at your shelter, at your home, everywhere. No safe place at that time.
We don't want to stay here at this school. They forced us to come here. We don't want to be here at this school. They are all liars.
People of the world find it impossible to believe that anyone, even a Zionist occupation force, would have the audacity to bomb the accommodation centers of the United Nations. The Israeli army had orders to kill anything that moved, and this policy was exercised throughout Gaza in their ground incursion. On the 16th of July, 2014, 8 children from the Bakr family went to play on the beach of Gaza. They were kicking around a soccer ball when from Israeli military ships in the sea, missiles fired on the beach, specifically targeting the children playing.
On July 16th, 2004, Ismail was sitting with his cousins. I told them that it was Ramadan and that they shouldn't be playing football and bothering the neighbors. The street is too narrow to play football. It's 2 meters wide, which is not enough room. All of us here are brothers and cousins. We live in a sector of homes the size of 1 square kilometer, which houses 1,000 people thereabouts. Ismail said he was going to play outside with his cousins. It was sunny and hot, so they went to the beach to play as they often do. It's not far, and it's the only suitable place to play, next to the part of the beach reserved for swimming.
Stay in here, son. There's shelling outside. He said he wanted to go to his uncle's house to play with their kids.
Ahid is my one and only grandson. He came after 9 granddaughters. Zakaria, my beloved son, the youngest. He was spoiled. He was my entire life. Whenever his father asked him, "Who loves you?" he always said, "He loves me."
I am accompanied by Al Said, Hamada, Yunus, Ismail, Ahid, and Muhammad, and we're heading now to the spot where we used to play as kids. We are fishermen, and so the sea is our life. We are always on the sea.
The Back family is a renowned family. We're known to be fishermen by trade. We inherited that from our fathers and from their forefathers who inherited it from Sheikh Back. The sea is life and breath to us. When our children want to play, they go to the beach.
We set up the goals here and divided ourselves into four teams and we played football. The boys said they're thirsty. They wanted to go drink some water and come back. I took them to get some water and when we came back,
we resumed and finished the first round. In the middle of the second round, Ismail kicked the ball and it landed next to the container. We asked him to go get it. He brought it back, along with Mortazim, Zachariah, Ahid, and Muhammad.
The warships were there. We saw that they were filming us. They sent a missile to the beach, and it wiped out my cousin. The first missile landed there, killed my cousin Ismail, and we started running to get off the beach.
The rest of the group came running toward us. We saw them, but Ismail wasn't with them. Bashir Abu Warfa was standing there. When he heard the explosion, he came out from the tent. He stood by us while we told him that Ismail was killed. The other children reached us.
They fired a second missile.
We decided, Hamada, Yunus and I, to hide behind the tent. Montasir was on the ground. They fired another missile at us as we fell behind the tent. Yunus hid in a barrel while Hamada and I kept running. Montasir ran with us. Hamada and Montasir entered the tent seconds after us. Bashir Abu Warfa was crying out, "O people, help us. The children are dead. The children are dead."
Four of those eight kids were basically vaporized when the bombs hit. Their young bodies could not be identified or even found amongst the debris left behind. The other four dispersed in different directions, not knowing the fate of each other, as more bombs actually followed them. Ambulances and journalists came, but it was all over.
Badly wounded, I crawled until I reached help. Someone laid me on the ground and left to bring an ambulance. They wrapped my head in a bandage and laid me down. I was in a coma, so at the time, I didn't know who was killed and who was still alive.
They laid Montasim by a wall, thinking he was dead. Hamas fainted. Yunus sat next to his brother, and I was weeping over my brother and cousins.
The other boy was with them. He came over yelling, "Mama, Mama." I said to him, "What's the matter?" He said, "Muhammad was martyred." I said, "How come Muhammad was martyred? Are you sure? You must be lying because Muhammad was here just now." He said that Muhammad was killed. I said he wasn't. But then I saw it air on TV, children killed on the beach. The girls cried. "He was our son of 20 years. We cry over you every day, son. You are never out of our thoughts."
Each day since the day Ismail was martyred, I have gone to the beach to spot where he was killed, and I've searched for his remains, hoping the sea had washed them up. I remembered that day vividly. When I reached the hospital, I realized what I had witnessed, a massacre against humanity. Where is the humanity? Ismail's senseless murder has forever taken the smile and joy from my home.
Zakaria, Ahid and Mutasim, who was injured but thought to be dead. Ismail and all of our kids were dead. I would not wish this on anyone. Everyone saw us on TVs and internet. What can I possibly say? I say occupation took my first grandson, who called me grandma.
The survivors of that tragic day come back to the beach, not to play as they did before, but to sit, to remember, vainly searching for a rational reason to an irrational act. It was a blatant war crime, which claimed the lives of their four relatives, with no one thus far held accountable. Meanwhile, they suffer from physical injuries themselves and the psychological trauma of it all.
Life without them is meaningless and full of despair. I'm not saying that because they are my brothers, but for the sake of all Palestinians, all of children. If I was flying a jet and I saw Jewish children playing, I wouldn't target them because they are just children playing. They could see from after that we were children.
They could tell we were a bunch of kids playing. They deliberately target and kill the children of Gaza and Palestine. They want to uproot them at a young age so they won't grow up and become resistors. So they bomb them at this young age.
Incredibly, shockingly, the targeting of Palestinian children escalated and peaked on the day of Eid al-Fitr, when the children of Gaza came out to play, to lighten up, relax, and have some fun to celebrate the last day of Eid, thinking that the Israeli army would not dare to violate such a holy occasion. Israel unmercifully sent missiles down, turning their brief period of joy to incomprehensible grief.
We live in Al-Ahrar Street at the beach camp, a major street in the camp area. We awoke on the day of Eid to enjoy it like everyone else normally does. The children were playing in the street, some were playing on the swings. All of a sudden, a missile landed on top of us. It was around 3 p.m. We were surprised by the explosion, but when we turned around, we saw the children had become shreds of flesh laying in the street. Some were injured and some others were dead.
I was playing on the swings when the missile landed. I got hit with shrapnel here. Some people were killed. My uncle Shaban, Jamal, and Muhammad were among those who died. I remember we were happy and playing on the day of Eid. Who could be so wicked as to bomb us on such a holy day? The children were out playing and rejoicing. And then the missile came, and in a second they were dead. Shaban had been blown apart. Others who died were Muhammad al-Halu, the Barid family's son, Muhammad Miqdad, and Muhammad Washah.
There were many martyrs, some scattered around on the ground, inside buildings, in trees, everywhere. The injured and the dead. Ambulances and cars swarmed on the location, and people were crying out in anguish for the loss of their children. 13 martyrs and 40 to 50 injuries. I sustained injuries to my leg and in my chest. My grandfather took my cousin and I to the ambulance.
My son was playing behind the car. He was almost next to me, but he died due to bleeding caused by a shrapnel penetrating his body. When the missile first landed, I was still conscious, receiving wounds to my stomach, legs, and arms. My leg disabled and my arm was broken and behind my back. I wore a white top which was covered in blood. I looked around just before I fainted to see the extent of the brutality and carnage. The scene was horrific, their actions so brutal.
Martyrs came from several refugee families at the beach camp on the first day of Eid after being targeted by an Israeli bombing campaign. On the third day of Eid, missiles of the Israeli occupation forces targeted some little kids who were playing with their grandfather with some simple new toys they had received for Eid on the roof of their home.
A truce was declared on television on the third day of Eid. We went up on the roof with all the little children. They wanted to play because it was a time of truce. They were not allowed to go out in the street because we worried about their safety.
After Salat al-Asr, about half an hour,
After 30 to 45 minutes of afternoon prayer, we heard more explosions. There was a first, second, and third explosion. It took some minutes to work out what had happened. Our house was filled with heavy smoke, and we realized that it was actually our house that had been bombed by an Israeli airstrike.
We rushed to the roof only to see the most horrifying scene. All that remained of the elderly man and the seven children that were playing were pieces of flesh and bone. At least three had their heads blown off. I looked over the martyred children. Two of my daughters were among the victims. One had survived. She had a hole in the back of her skull. Another girl was also alive, but couldn't talk. I called her and she looked up at me, so I rushed them to the hospital.
I searched around to collect my children. First I took Abd al-Halim, then I went back inside and got Abd al-Aziz. His head had been split open. I couldn't remove my third daughter. I couldn't find her head. Then I came downstairs and stood here at the doorstep. They took away the bodies of the martyrs in ambulances. I wanted to see whether they took the body of my daughter or not. I found my niece Malik, the daughter of Jalal. I kissed her forehead and I was about to leave with the ambulance. As I was stepping out of the ambulance, a rocket from an unmanned drone hit us. My leg was hit and had to be amputated. This finger and my arm were injured too. It was a cruel airstrike. In all, there were 10 martyrs from my family, including 7 children, my parents, my brother and his daughter, and my cousin who was carrying the bodies of martyrs at the time he was hit.
After the disproportionate aggression on the population of Gaza, there are still survivors today who suffer heightened psychological effects, reflected clearly in their behavior, which is especially telling during play activities such as painting that express the evil acts that Israel perpetrated against them.
Usually after the therapy process and even after recovery, there will still be some trauma symptoms among the affected children, with most of them on edge, in high alert mode, expecting more attacks on them. That's why you find that whenever a child is playing or drawing, the played-out theme tends to represent the incident, which is causing the alerted state from their memories, from their nightmares. When we spoke to children aged around 12 who survived the last three wars, who witnessed and suffered trauma from the 2008 Israeli-imposed war and this one in 2014. After recovering from each war and after being treated, they still believe that there would be another war and another. Three wars lived through by a child. The trauma is unimaginable, and the child is left in a state of constant alertness. We can't even tell them that they are safe, that there will be no more wars, or that everything is now fine.
Whenever they unleash a war on us, we will resist and defeat them.
It is beyond any reasonable doubt that targeting children of Palestine is part of the culture and a systematic issue of the Israeli occupation army, which seeks to brand the conscious mind of all Palestinian children with the ideology that they are all the undeserved, the subhuman, that there can be no Palestinian flag, no independence, no resistance.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome back to Back to Reality. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. I'm from the UK and here in the studio we have a very, very special guest with us.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brother Habib Za'atar at your service, born in Los Angeles, California, and half of my life I've been living here in Qom.
I've been to California, actually.
It's a nice place.
So strange, isn't it, coming from that background to this background? It's a completely different world.
One of the toughest things that we went through as a family when we left California and we arrived in Qom was the cultural differences.
Mm-hmm.
It was very awkward.
Wait, so you left with your family and you came to Iran?
When we came here, it's a long story.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came with my mother and my brothers, when we first arrived here, it was so strange. The food, the people, you know, the interactions, the simplest of things.
The food.
The verse, فَلْيَنْدُرْ الْإِنسَانِ إِلَىٰ طَعَامِهِ. Imam Baqir alayhi salam gives an explanation, an internal explanation.
So the verse,
Sirah al-Batin.
Yeah, so the verse says, so let mankind look at his food.
Exactly. You know, like, where did this food come from? Is it from a clean source? Is it from a dirty source? Is it from halal income? Is it from haram income? Who baked it? Who made it? Is it going to make damage me? Is it good for me? Do I eat it all? Do I eat few? That's the external interpretation of it. Imam Baqir alayhi salam, when asked about this verse, what does he state? He states, it means to look at the knowledge that you gain from where you gain it.
Subhanallah. Ahsan. Exactly.
Where do you gain your information from?
Mm.
Where do you get your knowledge from?
Who are your teachers?
Exactly.
Who
brought this information?
I want to point this out as well. Who's babysitting your children?
Yeah. That we're going to get to that. We'll get to that. But where does this knowledge come from? Why did they give me this knowledge? Analyze it. This doesn't only go with the knowledge of, you know, of religion. It doesn't only go with the knowledge of, for example, of your material life, but also the information that we gain in social media. Unfortunately, what I've noticed from, especially from TikTok videos, especially from Instagram reels, which are like 30 seconds, the time span that you have is very short. And when you have that short time span, there are a couple of harms, of cons that come with this. First of all, Your focus goes away. If you see Sheikh Habib talking, you're going to get bored.
No, right? I can't get bored listening to
you. Okay, fine. I'll take that as a compliment. And the second thing is that we lose the power to analyze.
Mm-hmm.
You see a video, right away you believe it. Wait a second.
Okay. Let me just contradict you here. Actually, I'm not going to contradict you. I'm going to add to that. Why do you lose your ability to analyze? There's this theory that it's about your laughs and your cries. The Holy Quran says, and it's Allah, وَإِنَّهُ هُوَ أَضَحَكَ وَأَبَكَ, and it is surely He who makes you laugh and weep.
Okay,
makes you laugh and cry. So when you laugh or you cry, your heart opens up, your guard comes down. At that point, they can deposit whatever ideologies they want to deposit into your heart, because it's open. At moments when you might not be like laughing, but if somebody does make you laugh, that's when they've got you. If a comedian makes you laugh, that's when you're more ready to accept his ideologies. If a movie reaches the crescendo, the climax, and it makes you cry, that's when the movie has impacted you. It's for that to the same effect. When we give majalis and the Maulana speaking on the minbar and he talks, he gives the whole lecture. At the end of it, he gives the musibah and you cry about Imam Hussein alayhi salam. At that point, everything that he said impacts you truly. Anyway, so my point was, when you're just scrolling, your guard is completely down. You might not be laughing outright. You might not be crying outright, but you're actually just entertaining yourself.
That's a very nice.
That's very nice to reflect on.
That's something nice to reflect on, ponder upon.
Because otherwise, if a news thing comes up, immediately your guard would go up. You're like, I'm not believing this.
We have to make sure, you know. But they throw in the ideas.
Mm.
You know, you're not giving, you know, as you said, your guard is down. You know, I remember that there's this book called The Ball. And it portrays it's the after materialistic time in the United States. Because the Christian majority was very religious. People were devoted, you know, to a point where women wouldn't picture themselves showing their ankles.
Yeah.
Materialistic life opened the door for them to what? To kind of unclinge off of religion.
I mentioned this before, but I just want to throw this in there. They found some footage from a major city in the UK.
And they're asking the woman, like, would you do this and do that?
No, it was silent. They didn't have audio at that time, I'm assuming. It's just like a black and white video. From 100 years ago, the street is entirely full of men and women. All of the women are in hijab.
Like in modest clothes?
No, in hijab. Hijab. Like, even some of them are wearing wimples. You know those bits that go up like that?
Yeah.
You see them. Just 100 years. That's how much society has transformed.
Yeah, and that's where this book comes in. This book tries to portray, for example, the LGBT movement and says, how do we push this agenda? How do we push it and make it as something as a norm? We start by what? Inserting it in commercials. We start by inserting it in TV shows. We start mm-hmm. to make it look normal.
Yeah.
When it looks normal, you're off guard. It becomes something normal. It doesn't become taboo.
Mm.
And that is why in the Arabic language, when I talk to, trying to defend the Islamic standpoint on LGBT, the first thing that I say is that don't change the name. Don't say Zawaj Mithli. Zawaj Mithli means same-sex marriage. That's the translation. I say Shadh, Shudud, which means what? Stray. Something out of the norm.
Mm.
So keep it out of the norm.
Ah,
even Martin Luther King was asked, on this topic, and he said that this is a sickness.
Yeah.
So it wasn't long ago where this was something considered to be a bad action. But because of propaganda coming forward, because of the agenda push that's available, what happens? It becomes something normal. Oh yeah, we could live with them, no problem.
Actually, this is one of the key ways that they actually influence us. And who do I mean by they? The people who have been pushing the sexual revolution. You must have heard of it. This whole feminism, LGBT, abortion rights, all of this stuff is to do at the core about sex. And what they have done continuously is they have pushed the agenda through language. The English language particularly, but it's gone into French and German and the other Western major languages. And as you just gave this example, they tried to push it into Arabic and other languages as well. And that's where they soften what this is really talking about. Yes. For example, why are we saying gay? Why are we calling somebody a gay man? You're a sodomite. That's what the actual thing is.
Yes.
And we know how the Bible talks about that. We know how the Quranic literature and the Islamic literature talks about that. Why do they call it gay? Because it softens it. It makes it seem like something acceptable. And this
English
is definitely...
English language gay means happy as well.
So yeah, it used to mean happy, yeah.
It used to mean... Thank you very much for saying that.
It's not used
enough. That's the reality, unfortunately, we're living in. But at the end of the day, we as Muslims, we should be aware of these agendas.
Mm-hmm.
We should be aware of these propagandas. And the A'imma alayhum as-salam, even the A'imma alayhum as-salam, fell into propaganda war with their enemies.
Mm.
Starting off with the mushrikeen of Quraysh.
Mm.
The mushrikeen of Quraysh would call out the Prophet what? A wicked man, a person crazy, a witch, a wizard.
Yeah.
That's how they started with the Prophet.
Mm.
And then it went with Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam.
Mm.
And then it continues with Imam Hassan alayhi salam. It continues with Imam Hussein, and then the rest of the Immas alayhi salam. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has a saying that we are Imma Sadiqoon.
Mm.
We are righteous imams. We are truthful imams. We say the truth. But there are people who fabricate. There are people who make up reports about us on our authority. And that is why it's very important to look at where we get our information from, how we got our information.
Yeah.
Alright, you're using the Quran. Now Muslims are using the Quran to put their point forward. We have this saying from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, if I'm not wrong, if it's in Najib al-Agha, that the Quran is like a sword. It could be used for the people who are what? Believers for non-believers. Every sect in Islam uses the Quran as their source or their reference or their evidence to prove their points. But at the end of the day, there has to be someone or something who is in charge of giving the true meanings of the Quran.
Of course.
And that's the main question that we ask after the Prophet. Who was it?
Mm.
Who was it? Why did they differ between themselves?
Mm.
Is it possible that the Prophet left his ummah, left his nation without someone to guide them to the Quran, the meaning of the Quran? We Shias believe that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam and then his household, his offsprings, are the ones who explain this. And using this in our Western culture to keep our identity.
Mm.
Using these teachings that we have, this experience actually that we have. Every information that comes up to you, even if it's coming from a mu'amma, even if it's coming from a scholar, you ask him, where did you get that from?
This is IRIB English Radio.